Hello, we're here today with Casey Lucius, a member of the Pacific Grove City Council and an announced candidate for the Republican nomination in the 20th Congressional District, a seat that's occupied by Congressman Sam Farr. Good morning, Casey. How are you?
Good morning. I'm great. Thanks for having me.
Great. You've been a member of the Pacific Grove City Council since being elected in 2012. You've decided to run for Congress. Tell us how you reached that decision, please.
Well, actually, it was several months of talking to friends and colleagues and my husband. And initially, the discussion centered around national security. That's my background, and that's what I've been studying in the field that I've been working in for the past 15 years. And generally, it centered around discussions of the need to make national security a priority in our country and really ensure that America has a legitimate and powerful presence in the world.
Okay, let's get into that in a little bit. Let's let the listeners know more about you. You were born in Brewster, Ohio, or you grew up there, or both?
Yes, I was born in Cincinnati, Ohio, and then moved to Brewster, Ohio in fourth grade, and that's where I continued elementary school and middle school and graduated from high school.
Now, in some of the campaign material you've prepared about yourself, you say, it is not my resume or my professional experience that brings me to this decision, which is to run for Congress. It is my personal life story. This story involves growing up in a low-income apartment in Ohio and wanting so badly to change the course of my future. Why don't you tell us more about your growing up and how that molded and developed you as a person?
Sure. So my parents are divorced, and my mom remarried a wonderful man named Ernie. And Ernie worked in a factory. My mom was a secretary in the school district. And I watched them struggle. I watched them live paycheck to paycheck. And I remember going to the grocery store with my mom on Saturday mornings. And, you know, she had a list and she stuck to the list. And sometimes we got to the cash register and we had to put things back. And I just remember, even as a kid, thinking, like, I don't want to live paycheck to paycheck. You know, I want something more for my life. And I didn't even know how to do that, but I knew that I needed to go to college. I knew that that was at least the first step. And I always loved school anyway. I loved learning. So that was just natural for me to want to go to college. But for example, my older sister didn't go to college. So it wasn't even though it was natural for me to think that way, it wasn't natural or automatic for my parents to send me to college. And so that was a big decision and a big struggle in our family.
Do you think you developed an empathy for people who are struggling paycheck to paycheck? Do you see it as something that is thrust upon them? Or do you think this is because people aren't basically doing what they should be doing to get ahead?
No, I think most people are working hard every single day, trying to make their lives better and trying to make their children's lives better. And it's just hard, you know? Prices are always increasing. Even if you're renting, rent is increasing. And even when you're trying to do the right thing and just trying to support your family, it can be a struggle. And so I definitely empathize with those families.
And then after high school, you went to Ashland, a small liberal arts school not far from where you grew up. What'd you study there?
I studied political science, and I actually graduated in 3 years, again, because I couldn't afford a fourth year. So I crunched as many classes as I could into 3 years, and I waitressed and worked as a resident assistant so that I could get free room and board. But we made it work, and again, thanks to Ernie's sacrifice and my mom's sacrifice, I was able to graduate from college.
And I see Ernie passed away not too many years ago.
He did. Unexpectedly, he passed away when he was only 62 years old. And that was another reason that really motivated me to do this, because I realized, in his death, I realized what a gift he gave me when he helped me go to college. But in his death, I also realized that life is short. And sometimes we want to wait for the circumstances to be perfect, We want to wait for somebody to say, okay, now is the time. But I decided I'm not going to wait. I'm going to live my life.
Now, was it immediately after you got your bachelor's degree in political science that you went to the Naval Postgraduate School?
No, actually, after I graduated from Ashland, I went to Columbus and worked at the Ohio House of Representatives. And I was an administrative assistant there for a state representative. And then I applied for Officer Candidate School. And I went to Pensacola, Florida, and got commissioned as a naval officer.
I see. And then you landed at the Naval Postgraduate School not too much after
Actually, after Officer Candidate School, then I went to Virginia for intelligence training, and then to San Diego, where I deployed on the USS Stennis.
Okay. Did you seem, in your own mind, predestined to enter the military? Was that something you had thought of growing up and as an undergraduate as well?
Well, no one in my family had ever served in the military, so it was really something that was unknown to me. But when I was in college, I read a lot about the Cuban Missile Crisis, and I read a lot about naval intelligence. And I just remember thinking, well, that sounds really cool. Maybe I could do that someday.
And so then
when I was actually, you know, kind of looking for a job and thinking about what I wanted to do with my life, and knowing that I did want to serve in some capacity, that's the route I decided to take.
Tell us about your military service.
So I served for 7 years as a naval intelligence officer, and my first deployment was in 1999 to the Persian Gulf. I was on an aircraft carrier, and we were enforcing UN sanctions against Iraq. So part of my job was monitoring ships that were leaving Iraq to see if they were carrying illegal oil. And then after 2 years on the carrier, I came to Monterey to the Naval Postgraduate School. And that's where I was able to earn my master's degree, and I met my husband.
And so you earned your master's in national security affairs in 2002. And then you went on and you earned a PhD at the University of Hawaii at Manoa in 07. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right.
Okay. Well, clearly you have a very interesting background, both your growing up years and your experience in the military. Let me diverge a little bit. You're seeking the Republican nomination in a district that is heavily Democrat. How do you look at the playing field and your chances?
Yeah, well, when you just look at the numbers, it doesn't look very promising, to be honest with you, and I realize that. But I also did a lot of research before making this decision, and what I found is that when you combined the entire district and San Benito and Santa Cruz and Monterey counties, it's actually about 50-50. It's 50% Democrats and then about 50% Republicans and independents. And so my goal is to really reach those independent voters, those people who feel disenchanted with both parties and are really looking for someone who's more moderate, someone who's practical and reasonable, and can work with people on both sides.
Do you anticipate others will enter the Republican field?
I don't think so, no.
If that's the case, then, and it's you and Congressman Farr in the June election, and you two are the number one and number two vote collectors, you would both then advance to the November primary under the November final under California law. So you could be looking at a really long campaign, something that would extend nearly to the end of 2016, and here we are in mid-2015. What are you going to do to try to get out there and get support, both voters and financial support, which is so key in any election?
Right. So basically for the next 6 months, my focus will be on raising money and endorsements and just getting my name out. Name recognition, I think, is really important. And meeting with as many groups of people as I can, going to Kiwanis and Rotary and the Chambers of Commerce, and just introducing myself and letting people know who I am and what I stand for and how I'll be different from Sam Farr. And then starting next year in January will be a real concerted effort in terms of actually spending the money on radio ads, TV ads, yard signs, etc.
A Supreme Court ruling about 5 years ago in Citizens United basically freed corporations and unions to give as much money as as they want to. What did you feel about that ruling?
Well, actually, so corporations can't donate to my campaign. They can't donate to an individual candidate, but they can donate unlimited to a PAC. I don't have a PAC. I have a campaign committee, so I'm not accepting money from corporations unless a PAC decides that they want to support me. Generally, I think the ruling, you know, I think the people on the Supreme Court are smarter than I am, and I generally trust their judgment. And in this case, I can see where it's frustrating for people because they feel like corporations are buying elections, and it certainly does seem that way sometimes. So in that regard, I don't support the decision. But in some ways, the decision also protects individuals. For example, my husband runs a nonprofit called Kairos Coalition, and he would be protected by that decision. So instead of someone suing him personally, they would sue the business, and then his business would take the hit rather than us personally taking the hit. So in some ways, I think for the purposes of elections, businesses as people don't make sense. But in terms of legal protections, I think it can make sense.
I see. Now, you mentioned your husband. You and he spent some time in Vietnam. Why don't you tell us about that?
We did. We were there from 2005 to 2008, living in Hanoi. And my husband was the Marine and Naval Attaché at the U.S. Embassy. And I worked as the operations assistant to the U.S. ambassador, which was basically like a chief of staff position. And I was able to travel around the country with the ambassador and attend meetings with him. And that was also part of my dissertation research. So I ended up writing a book about that experience.
Now, the Vietnam War was a very divisive element in American history in the 60s and 70s. What was your sense of how the Vietnamese regarded Americans?
Well, in that time, in 2005 to 2008, and even today, I think I can confidently say they love Americans. They appreciate all of the economic investments that the U.S. has made in Vietnam. And Vietnam has actually taken on a leadership role in the region in terms of its chairmanship of ASEAN. They've been a rotating member of the U.N. Security Council, and they've joined the World Trade Organization. So they've really emerged as a stable and reliable partner in the region.
And ASEAN being the Asian Security Pact?
Yes.
So you moved here, back here in, I think you said you moved to Pacific Grove in 2008.
Yes.
You ran for office the first time and the only time, I presume, in 2012. What was it that you said, you know, I'm gonna run for PG City Council?
Well, I actually started out volunteering on a couple boards and commissions. I was on the ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act Advisory Board, and then I was on the Traffic Safety Commission. And as a result of being on those boards and commissions, I attended city council meetings. And one of the things I noticed was there wasn't a lot of representation for women, and there wasn't a lot of representation for families. Most of the members of the council are retired. And Pacific Grove is actually full of families, full of young people who are working. And so when I decided to run, I made my pitch to people that I was going to represent that demographic, those parents and families who are out there working every day who don't have time to go to city council meetings. I would be their voice. And that really seemed to resonate.
And you mentioned the makeup of the Pacific Grove City Council. You're the only woman, correct?
Yes, I am.
And charitably speaking, you're probably the only one younger than 60, perhaps?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Moving on to some of your position that you talk about on your website, I would depict you, and correct me or modify what I'm saying, you come across as kind of a moderate Republican. How would you describe yourself?
I describe myself as fiscally conservative and conservative on national security policy and defense. But on social issues, including gay marriage, immigration, abortion, I'm more moderate or liberal. I guess I'd like to say more open-minded and practical on those issues, recognizing that society has evolved, and I think the Republican Party needs to evolve in some ways as well.
You supported the recent Supreme Court ruling on marriage equality?
Yes.
Okay. And what about the ruling dealing with basically where the Supreme Court affirmed the Affordable Care Act, known as Obamacare?
Yes.
What was your thinking on that?
I think that was actually a good thing because one of two things would have happened if that were, if the subsidies were overturned. I do think there can be made, there needs to be improvements to the Affordable Care Act. But as a result of the Affordable Care Act, 4 million people have been able to access health insurance. And so if that decision overturned the subsidies, in some ways, that health care would have been ripped out from under them. And I don't think that would have been a good thing. Or the federal government wouldn't have been able to provide the states with the financial backing to provide those subsidies. And so then it would have put the states in a bind. And then that trickles down to the local governments, which is what we're seeing here in Monterey County. So I was actually pleasantly surprised with the Supreme Court decision.
Immigration, your issue paper says, the agricultural and tourism economies of the Central Coast of California are dependent on immigrant labor. Those who are willing to do backbreaking work, pay taxes, and follow the law so they might have a chance at a better life in America. And then very interesting is that you quote Emma Lazarus's poem with the famous line, "Give me your tired poor, your huddled masses yearning to be free," which is yearning to breathe free, which is at the base of the Statue of Liberty. The immigration issue is a very hot one, both locally and nationally. If you were in Congress, what would you like to see happen?
I think many people try to tackle immigration from a broad overhaul perspective. And in some ways, I just think that's too overwhelming. I think there are probably some small changes that we could make that would really improve the system and be easy for people to accept. So for example, right now we have visas for seasonal workers, we have visas for skilled workers and unskilled workers, but those numbers are capped. So for example, for seasonal workers, they're like 140,000, but we actually have millions of people seeking those seasonal work visas. So raising those caps would be one change that could be made, which probably wouldn't upset too many people and would be a huge improvement to the system. Another improvement would be having a year-long visa program for unskilled workers. That's a visa that doesn't exist right now. We could create a new visa category, again, that would make a huge improvement to the system and I think would be easy for people to accept.
You talk about gun rights. You say, I support the Second Amendment and the right of self-defense. Do you think there are any type of weapons that should not be allowed that the public could buy either in gun shows or over-the-counter at gun shops?
You know, I'm sure that there are, and I have to say I've gotten a lot of flack for this particular issue paper. And I think it's because we've seen so many recent school shootings and shootings in churches and theaters, places where people should feel safe, and yet they've seen these incidents happen, and then they want to step in and have the government, limit gun rights. And the first thing I think of is I think of my sister and my aunt. They're both women who live alone, and they both have guns. And I wouldn't want the government coming in and saying they can't have guns for whatever reason, right? Because if that's something that they believe they need to have to feel safe and for self-defense, I want them to be able to honor that right and have that right. So I'm sure that there are some weapons that, you know, we've talked about, you know, automatic, semi-automatic weapons or weapons that have certain number of magazines. Maybe those should be outlawed. And that's where I think we can turn to the police for their advisement and for their recommendations on what weapons should be limited to the public.
You're in favor of Roe v. Wade, which has been the law of the land for over 40 years now. Are there any? Is there a certain trimester or a certain period in pregnancy where you would be opposed to a woman aborting a birth?
Yes, actually, I think once the baby is viable, then I think the state has a responsibility to protect human life. And that's basically what the Supreme Court has said, is that prior to viability, a woman has that choice. After viability, then we recognize that child as a life and the state protects life. There are still some exceptions to that, obviously, in the case of the health of the mother. But I think it's also important to include in this discussion the rights of fathers. That's something that we don't talk about very much when we talk about the abortion debate. And so as you'll see in that issue paper, I talk about spousal notification and parental notification for minors. This is an issue where it's very layered and very complex and very sensitive. And yet we try to describe it with these short snippets of pro-life or pro-choice. And I think it deserves a lot more attention than that.
Who would define viability?
Well, interestingly, it's usually determined either by the medical profession or by scientists. And I think it varies somewhere between 24 weeks and 28 weeks, depending on who you ask.
How would you differentiate yourself from Congressman Farr? Where do you see positions that he has taken and you would not take? And also proactively, what positions would you take that maybe haven't been addressed?
So one of the big differences will be in supporting small businesses. If you look at Mr. Farr's record, one of the things you'll notice consistently is that he has voted against every small business bill in the last 5 years. And some of those bills are simply to offer lending options for small businesses. Some help to define part-time or full-time. So some of the bills are significant, some are less significant, but he has consistently voted against every bill that would aid and support a small business. And I find that surprising because this is a district that's made up of small businesses. We don't have large manufacturing here. We are a district of small businesses. And so I would do everything I can to support the small businesses in our area. Another area is support for our military and for defense. He has also voted against authorizations, funding authorizations for the Department of Homeland Security and the Department of Defense. Again, I think that needs to be a top priority in our country and in our community. And then water. We haven't seen, we haven't had a strong voice or strong leadership on the water issue. And that's probably the most important issue for residents of this district. And so I would really advocate for federal funding for water infrastructure for our district.
How do you feel about the work of the mayor's committee that's gone on to deal with water issues?
Yeah, I have to say when that group started back in 2011, I wasn't in favor because I thought that their work might undermine the Monterey Peninsula Water Management District, which is also an elected body. But what I have seen over recent years has been quite impressive. What you see are the mayors coming together and really seeking a regional solution to the water problem and really coming together to back one project and to also to convince the citizens and the communities to support a project and really to get water quickly and affordably to the people of the peninsula.
Being a council person and running for Congress, most people would say that's a big step. Had you considered running for the Board of Supervisors, State Assembly, or State Senate?
I did consider them, but what I realized pretty quickly was that the issues that I'm most interested in and the area where I think I can contribute the most is at the national level. I'm mostly interested in those issues surrounding U.S. foreign policy and national security, things like the national budget and the deficit. And so while running for supervisor, running for state assembly might make more sense to some people, it didn't make sense to me because what made sense to me was going for a position where I could make the best contribution.
Speaking of national issues, let's look at a couple. The present negotiations going on with Iran, and then overall American foreign policy in the Middle East. How do you gauge things?
So first, starting with Iran, I think that the negotiations with Iran are problematic in terms of the details of the deal. For example, the criticism of the deal basically is that Iran will be able to keep their nuclear facilities, some of their nuclear facilities open. They'll also be able to keep about 5,000 centrifuges, which are used to enrich uranium. And they'll also be able to keep some of their nuclear fuel stockpiles. So the deal is basically for them to make reductions, but not to get rid of anything. And so that's where you see a lot of criticism, is that really the deal isn't strong enough for the U.S. Having said that, I think it's better to have a deal than no deal. I think it's important for us to continue to negotiate with Iran, and it's absolutely essential that we have a reliable and responsible partnership with Iran, because Iran is probably going to be the regional leader in the Middle East over the next decade. And so as much as we can shape Iran's future, it will be to our benefit.
Do you think Iran and the Saudi Arabians should be doing more together, perhaps in dealing with ISIS?
Well, it would be great if they did, but it's unlikely. And the reason it's unlikely is because of the Sunni-Shia divide. So Saudi Arabia is one of our biggest allies in the region, and yet they are not really stepping up to fight ISIS because Saudi Arabia is Sunni-dominated and ISIS is Sunni-dominated, and they won't fight each other. So what you have is you have Iran, who is typically not an ally of the United States, fighting against ISIS because Iran is Shia, and so they're fighting the Sunni ISIS terrorist group. So it makes for strange bedfellows, as you hear people say, in which case, you know, we would like to have Jordan and Turkey and Saudi Arabia really stepping up in the fight against ISIS, and they're holding back because of those religious affiliations, and in which case we have found ourselves working with the Iranians and working with the Kurdish Peshmerga in fighting ISIS. And really, those are the two biggest and most capable groups that are out there on the ground fighting ISIS right now, and we need them.
Is Iraq a nation that can exist in its current layout? It was basically created by imperialistic powers early in the 20th century, and it just seems, is it possible to govern Iraq by anyone, or should it be divided into separate countries?
I think ultimately it will be divided into separate countries. The Kurds have already said that they're going to divide the country and form their own sovereign state. And they've basically kind of announced to the world that they have earned that right because they are the only capable fighters on the ground fighting ISIS and able to fight back against some of the violent extremism. So I think you will see at least northern Iraq break off into its own state. And then there may be some division between Sunnis and Shias in Iraq, and that's something that probably will be caused by a civil war in Iraq. We've already seen that over the last couple of years, and it's likely to continue unless we have a leader in the region or unless the U.S. asserts itself and tries to stop that war.
Is ISIS a real threat to the United States at this point?
I think it is. There's been significant debate about this, but I absolutely think ISIS is a threat to the United States. And the reason I say that is because ISIS has members who are Americans who have U.S. passports. They also have members who are Europeans with European passports. And those individuals can freely travel to the United States without visas, without any border checks. And they can come and carry out attacks in the United States. And I believe they will. I think it's just a matter of time.
So you believe that we're in serious danger of what might be called a lone wolf attack?
Yes. But I think the lone wolf attack that we typically think of is kind of small scale. I think it's more likely that we'll experience a larger scale attack in the next decade.
America's key ally in that region has been Israel. The United States helped Israel virtually from the day of its inception in 1948. Where do you see that relationship now, and what should our relationship be with Israel?
Well, Israel is an important ally. Again, we need as many stable and responsible countries in that region as we can get, and Israel's one of them. Israel also has a very capable military, so they can defend themselves and they can defend their interests and U.S. interests in the region. So it's important for us to be a good partner and to be reliable with Israel. However, I don't think that we can jeopardize relations with other countries in the region because of Israel. So I don't want to sound contradictory, but I think it's something that has to be balanced, where we can be a legitimate partner in the region overall.
Netanyahu's visit to the United States not that long ago got kind of muddy President Obama didn't meet with him. He was invited by Speaker Boehner from your native Ohio. And I used to live in Ohio, too. How do you think that impacted U.S.-Israeli relations and also how the U.S. is perceived in the Mideast? Was Israel's position weakened vis-a-vis other countries? Or how would you see it?
I think it did. In some ways, I think it did undermine Israel's position in the Middle East because the president didn't meet with him. I think anytime you have a head of state, a president or a prime minister visiting the U.S., he or she should meet with our head of state, should meet with the president. And the fact that he could come here at the invitation of Congress, speak to Congress and not meet with the president, I think showed that our relationship is on rocky ground.
Let me throw something else at you. You were a poli-sci major. You've got extensive experience in the military and also overseas. Who are your heroes, living or dead?
Well, Abraham Lincoln is a kind of an easy and obvious one to point to because of his clear leadership skills. But I also really like Earl Warren. Earl Warren was a governor here in California, and he was a Republican, but he was successful because he was really nonpartisan. And what I have found in studying, you know, heroes, I guess as you call them, or people who I admire in politics, are those people who are most successful are the ones who don't get stuck in political ideology, but people who can really be open to both sides of the debate and really look at issues based on their merit, which is exactly what I want to do. And I think we can look at people like Earl Warren, who did that here in California. And I'd like to see more of that in California, honestly.
Let me ask you something else we haven't gotten into. Why don't you tell us about your family?
So I'm married to my husband, Bob Lucius, who's a retired Marine. He served in the Marine Corps for 23 years, and he now works for the Humane Society of the United States. Actually, the Humane Society has an international program, and they have offices in Asia. So he runs their Asia program, and he's working hard to save dogs and cats and animals throughout Asia, and also to teach young people about humane treatment of animals and conservation of the environment. So he's an amazing person. And we have a son, Bobby, who's 5, who's also amazing and very rambunctious and energetic, and he keeps us on our toes. But he also is one of the reasons I'm doing this, because I'm thinking, you know, 10 years from now, 15 years from now, what's his life going to be like? You know, will he be able to find a job here? Will he be able to afford a house here? Will we be able to afford college for him? I'm thinking about the future, and I'm thinking about Bobby, and it really drives me to continue this process.
Being a 5-year-old, is Bobby in school now?
He's in summer camp, and he'll go to kindergarten at Forest Grove in August.
Okay, and I notice you say you support school choice, so your son's going to be going to public school.
He is.
Okay, you say in your issue paper on education, parents should be able to select from charters, private schools, public schools, or homeschooling. Do you think that tax dollars should be spent for someone who sends a child to a private school?
Well, actually, you know, that's a good question, because we sent Bobby to a private school for pre-K, and at the same time that we were paying tuition for that private pre-K, we were also paying our property taxes, 60% of which goes to the PG public school. And so it doesn't seem unjust to me that some tax dollars could be diverted to help families pay for private schools. Now, we happen to be in a very good school district, which we're grateful for, but some families aren't as lucky. And I think those families that aren't in a good public school district but want to send their children to private school, it would be great if they could get some support from the government to have that option.
One of your position papers, you talk about technology and cybersecurity. I was told you had to explain to the council, maybe that's not the right word, about the value of fiber optics. Is Pacific Grove, you feel up to speed in that field?
Well, I feel up to speed in terms of cybersecurity and the vulnerabilities that we have here in the United States. One of the things that Pacific Grove is looking at is installing fiber optics as a service to our businesses and residents. And that's an area where I don't think any of us are up to speed, which is why the council was hesitant to approve a contract with SiFi. So I have since met with the company and learned more about it, and I'm feeling more comfortable with that decision. But it is, it's kind of hard for, I think, our community to wrap their head around that one.
It's not just your community. It's lots of people have a difficulty with that.
Yes.
Then the company is actually called SiFi?
It is.
That's a great name. One last question, or maybe it isn't the last. Transportation, you talk about that. There's been talk of a toll road in Monterey County. Have you assessed the pluses and minuses of that?
Yes, actually, I serve as the alternate on the TAMC Board of Directors. So,
and TAMC being Transportation Agency of Monterey County?
Yes, thank you. And so that has been a long and ongoing discussion with that agency and with the public and board members. And it does seem to me, again, this is where I think we've had a lack of leadership and decisiveness from Mr. Farr, because he's been in office for 22 years and we still haven't had any highway funding to widen or to rebuild Highway 156. And that's something that's been talked about for at least 10 years and probably longer. And now we're talking about another 10-year project to rebuild 156. And the truth is, the only way that that will be paid for will be from tolls. So really the question isn't whether or not there will be tolls. I think the question will be whether it will be privately run or publicly run.
Let's assume you get elected, and let's assume January of 2017 rolls around and you're sworn in. What are the first couple of things you want to focus on besides finding a place to live? Where do you want to go as a congressperson if you are elected?
Well, I think the two things that I would really like to focus on are national security and water for this district. And one of the things I think that I would like to do right away is stop any cuts to the Department of Defense. Because of the Budget Control Act in 2011, there have been automatic cuts to the DoD budget. And I think that sends a message to the rest of the world that we no longer want to be engaged. We're tired as a country. We don't want to deploy our troops anymore. And I think we have to turn that message around. And the first way to do it would be to stop those cuts. And then on water, again, I think we need to have a strong voice to get federal funding for water infrastructure, but also to change some of the regulatory burdens that stand in the way of us building new water sources. So, for example, if we have an emergency drought plan, part of that plan could include exemptions, special exemptions to the Endangered Species Act during severe drought. And that would have to be done through legislation at the congressional level.
You talk about defense spending. Does the country have enough money for guns and butter?
I think we do. I think we have to get our priorities straight, and we have to decide. I mean, I think education, obviously, I'm a big advocate of education, and I think education should be a top priority in our country. And I think public safety should be a top priority in our country. And public safety comes at all different levels, from the local level, local police, to the state level, to the federal level. And I think as long as we invest in those two areas and people feel safe and they feel like they have opportunities, then we're on the right track.
Casey, is there anything that you would like to bring up that I haven't asked you?
I don't think so, but I want to thank you for this opportunity. And I just want to add that so far I have received a very positive response to my announcement to run. And I'm grateful for all the people who have met with me and donated to the campaign. And I'm just really looking forward to earning their votes.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Casey Lucius, who's a announced candidacy for the Republican nomination for Congress in the 20th District, a seat that has been held by Democrat Sam Farr since 1993. The primary will be in June of 2016, and the top two vote-getters, regardless of party, would then advance to the November general election. Casey Lucius, thank you very much.
Thank you.